Hi, he's Marlin and I'm Dory, and welcome to the Unstable Fluid Podcast.
Okay. This one seems oddly fitting given where I was on Thursday, but...
I feel like I'm bringing Dory vibes today, so...
What, just keep swimming, or just forgetting everything?
Just keep swimming, ooh, look, a fishy, and where am I? That's...
You're on the podcast, Kat.
Oh, good. We have a podcast?
We do, allegedly.
That's exciting. How are you, Thomas?
I'm good. I'm too warm. Probably not quite as warm as you, but too warm. We are in... I've lost count of how many heat waves we've had in the UK this summer.
At what point does it just become one continual heat wave?
I don't know. I'm still getting used to the idea of a summer that lasts longer than about 3 days. So...
Are you noticing like a massive difference between the north and the south?
Yeah. I think I checked the difference in temperature between Cardiff and where I grew up today. Mm-hmm. And Cardiff's meant to top out at like 27. Back home is 20. Like, it's a 7-degree delta.
Okay, so we're all going to visit your family soon, yes?
This heatwave doesn't abate, yeah?
Amazing. I can't segue. You do it.
I can't segue. You do it. That's the tagline for the podcast. But you're right, we do have to segue. Because today we have our first guest. So welcome, Megan.
Woo!
Hello. Thank you for having me.
If you were a character in Finding Nemo, which Finding Nemo character would you be?
Probably Dory, honestly.
Yes, these are good vibes. Sorry, Thomas. It's two against one now.
Yeah, okay. You just chose mine for me, so...
This is true. Actually, can I petition myself to change to the stone turtle?
Sure.
That seems pretty fitting.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Megan. But also, no, thank you for joining us here. We are super excited to have you on the podcast.
And thank you for being our first guest and putting up with all of the technical difficulties before we got started.
You mean the ones that I cause? Yeah, thank you for putting up with yourself. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, hey, this is what you want, guys. If you have a dream to be on a podcast, just never, ever let them forget it. And eventually it might come true. 100% success rate so far.
Casual nudges, little hints here, then
there. Yeah. Occasional reminders in Twitch chat.
No, subtle, so subtle.
That's me, really subtle.
No, we are super excited to have you. Speaking of you, why don't you tell us, introduce yourselves to future you as you listen to this podcast, but also the other listeners that I'm sure we have. Hi, chat.
So I am finally a PhD student at the University of Bristol. I am part of the Quantum Engineering TDT, which doesn't exist anymore. I've been reborn as the Quantum Information Science and Technologies TUT, I believe. My PhD is in quantum memories, so I'm a quantum physicist by trade. Sorry, Kat.
Fine, Kat's a physicist too, it's fine.
No, I'm not!
But I am Welsh, woo! So there's that. Yeah, that's kind of what I do.
That's the cool vibe. I was gonna be honest, when you said I'm at the CDT that doesn't exist anymore, that was a bit harrowing. Like, you just hang around long enough and then it'll be fine.
No, it's just I'm the eighth cohort of the original CDT, which was funded twice. There was 10 rounds, but the third round was reincarnated and something just slightly different, so it does exist just under a different name. But it's fun when you try and Google my CDT, the new one comes up and they're like, this one. I'm like, no, this one. This little one dying out in the corner.
Yeah. So that's far more optimistic than mine. So I'm the final year of my CDT and we didn't get refunded, so mine legitimately doesn't really exist anymore.
Just fading into obscurity. There's a graveyard of CDTs somewhere. And for context, if you have never heard the acronym CDT, which there will be a lot of three-letter acronym TLAs dotted out throughout this episode, someone count them all and let us know. Centers of Doctoral Training, which we are all victims of, sufferers of, a nicer word. Yeah.
Slightly benefiters of? I don't know, like... I wouldn't have had a PhD without it, so...
You haven't got a PhD yet. Sorry.
I wouldn't have had a stipend without it.
True.
Because all the ones that I applied to that weren't CDTs didn't let me in.
Aw.
This is the only one I applied to, and I applied twice, and only got an interview the second time. So I really did not hedge my bets at all. Don't recommend, kids. If you want to do a PhD, maybe more than one application might be required. I got very lucky.
I mean, it depends where you're going for, right? Like, if you want to do a very specific PhD... That's true. And that's the only one you want to do, but other things are good, then there's nothing wrong with that if But be aware, yeah, one application if the goal is do any PhD. It's a high risk, high reward situation.
Off the back of that, I'm going to completely change up the order of the things we were going to talk about, because we've landed on this one rather organically, which is, like, can you tell us a bit about your journey to the PhD, like how physics, how research, and how you ended up in Bristol?
Yes. How far back?
As far back as you want to go.
Do we want to go?
Right, so toddler.
No, we will go back to sort of roughly A-level time. So I was not having a fun time at A-levels. The mental health was negative. I originally wanted to be a chemist, and the only teacher in my school that was a doctor was not fantastic. So I dropped chemistry. I was like, well, what else am I good at? I can do maths. Okay, I guess. Oh, I'll do physics.
Right choice.
My cat will probably go, no, you should have just done maths.
Just the pipeline of, oh, I like maths. I'm good at maths. I'm going to go do this other science. Like, it breaks my heart every time.
I can break it more, which is I wanted to do maths for a reason.
Okay.
I need a reason to do my maths. And therefore I went physics. That makes sense.
There's reasons to do math.
So I did maths, physics, economics, and the Welsh Baccalaureate. If there's any other Welshies out there, knows the struggle. It was a full A level at the time, so that sucked. And I applied to Bristol, ironically, and a couple of other places with my heart set on going to Southampton, which did not happen. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going through clearing, which at the time was like the end of my life. Mm. I was devastated. But I went through clearing and I went to Swansea, mm-hmm. despite saying to myself, I will leave Wales for my degree. Went really well, but I had the best time of my life at Swansea. Going through clearing was actually conversely one of the best things that ever happened to me, which me back then would not have believed me at all. Mm-hmm. And so I finished at Swansea just as COVID sort of happened. And then I did my master's at Cardiff, all online, which is really, really fun. The viewers can't see the face I'm pulling, but it was real fun. And then applied to Bristol and got in on my second application. I applied the first time just finishing my bachelor's because they don't require a master's. So I was like, I'll give it a go. And got shortlisted, but not interview. And then started the PhD back in September of 21, mm-hmm. I think. So yeah, I'm just starting my fourth year, which is good fun because I should submit next month, but I'm not. That's fun. We can touch on that maybe a bit later.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the academic journey of, I did the Cardinal Sin of going Swansea and then Cardiff. Only the biggest derby in Welsh universities.
Yeah.
I got spat at once in Cardiff Central train station for wearing a Swansea hoodie.
Oh my God.
Despite the fact that I basically grew up in and around Cardiff, that sort of nearest big place to where I'm from. Yeah. So that was extra painful.
Yeah.
And I still haven't lived it down with my Swansea friends.
I can't get over actually how similar our stories are, which is something I didn't fully realize, because I have basically the same story. I never went to Swansea University, but flip Swansea and Cardiff in that thing of like nearest-esque place. Grew up, was definitely going to leave Wales, went to Cardiff through clearing. Thought, again, you think that that's the world ending, but it's arguably one of the best things ever. Which is always a nice thing of like, you're still going to a university, you're still getting to go somewhere, and almost having that choice sort of absolved a bit. There's less pressure, and I got to just enjoy it.
Not to disrupt the flow at all, but looking at the analytics for our podcast, we have quite a few international listeners. So does one of you want to explain what clearing is? Because I think this is a fairly UK-specific thing.
In UK higher education system, when you finish school at 18... if you are going to go on to university, there is a very specific way that you apply, which is, I believe, still through UCAS, which stands for something that I will never know.
University and College Admission Service.
Thank you, Thomas. So you apply through, and Oxbridge get to be special. So Oxford and Cambridge are special and they sit off on their own corner. But typically you would apply to up to 5 universities, of which you choose 2, one to be your first choice and one to be your insurance choice. At which point that you then get your grades, you either get into your first choice, or if you don't get the grades for that, you then get assigned your insurance choice. The other 3 that you applied to, you had to reject and no longer count. So you only really get 2 options. If you don't make the grades for either of those 2 things, or you get the grade point equivalent, but the university is evil and hold you on for too long and then reject you afterwards, talking from personal experience, you then get put into clearing, which is, I think, currently happening, depending on the time of release, currently happening in the UK as we speak, just to put some pressure on Thomas. which is basically where universities that don't have enough students or haven't filled their maximum capacity of students, because let's be honest, there's loads of people there, open up to anyone. So you ring around the universities through clearing that still have spaces and go, hello, can I come here, please? And then you tell them your grades, and it's much more of a free-for-all than the formal application process. And it's stressful because you've just got your exams. There's quite a strict deadline if you want to make that upcoming academic year. Normally, it's undergrads on the phone that you're ringing that are, you know, very stressed as well because they're dealing with hundreds of calls coming in. And it's quite a, I don't know, I found it a very, like, stressful, intense process. I don't know if you feel the same, Megan. If you like remember or just blocked that time of your life.
So I would like to add I had the extra special case, which was I was rejected from my firm and got into my insurance, but I chose not to go. I gave up my place because I had, being honest, I'd only chosen somewhere because one of the universities the Firefly applied to, I refused to interview for. So I immediately lost an option. And all the others wanted the same kind of grades apart from my insurance. And I only put it there because I knew I would definitely make the grade. And I was probably more upset about the idea of going to that university than I was about not getting into my dream university. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was extra funny because I was, as Kat was saying, ringing around all the universities. And I spoke to someone at Swansea and they were, firstly, the most Welsh person I've ever heard in my life. And also supremely keen. And I turned around the teachers were in the room, so we're using the teacher's staff room phone. Context as well to the listeners, I went to Welsh Medium Education. Mm-hmm. So I turn around, still crying, to these teachers, and I'm like, oh, I've heard back from Swansea. And all four or five teachers in that room went, oh, I got my PGCE at Swansea.
Yeah.
Which tells you a lot. And they were mega, mega keen. So that kind of put me at ease a little bit. And I found out actually when I was leaving to go home that day, because Swansea had a clearing open day the next day, which I was like, okay, I'll go and then I'll make a choice. But the only other person that had done physics, the other girl that had done physics, was also going to Swansea probably. So I was like, I'll know one person. Yeah. I'll know one person. It was a fun time, but reassured by the other people being like, I've been there, it was all right. I'm like, that might have been like 20 years ago, but I'm sure it'd be fine.
It hasn't changed, I promise you.
No, it hasn't.
20 years time difference in Swansea is all the same.
I think clearing is currently in progress for Scotland at the minute. We're not at A-level results day, so it probably hasn't started up England, Wales and Northern Ireland yet.
I remember I had to do a thing looking at university websites and there were a few, so maybe it was the Scottish ones that had like clearing now open and it's in big bold letters. And
I definitely saw stuff about like Dundee having clearing places open and that sort of thing.
Fair enough.
I actually have a question on that, I guess aimed at Thomas, in that since our clearing is later than yours, like what's the turnaround if you were like an English or Welsh student going through clearing and then starting a Scottish university? Is that like basically immediate or?
The turnaround is very fast because A-level results day this year is the 14th of August. Most Scottish universities, the like first day of Freshers Week will be, I think this year, like the 8th of September.
Oh, wow.
Wow, okay.
Scottish unis start better part of a month before unis in the rest of the UK, because the entire Scottish academic calendar is about a month earlier because summer attempts. attempts at summer.
Bristol did that recently where they've brought the academic year forward by 2 weeks, and it's caused a lot of chaos when trying to torch out the universities because it means that the exam dates and stuff don't align.
The Scottish unis are already like a couple of weeks behind the Scottish schools going back. The reason that they go back when they do is it's the earliest that they can start and still get students from the rest of the UK.
I guess that's something that people should consider when like looking at undergrad universities as well, is that time shift, if that's going to matter too much. I just remember the half terms always being confusing, like moving to Bath for PhD, and then it's like, oh, it's half term, I'll go home, and then going to Wales, and it's like, no, it's not half term yet. Ah!
But yeah, I think, so we've talked quite a bit about like the choice of how you chose universities and stuff, but I guess the next question is, well, what sort of gave you that idea of like, I want to go and do a PhD, I want to be doing research for 4 years?
That is a good question. I would be lying if I didn't say a part of it was the, I don't want to go into the big world yet. That sounds scary. I can do more science. That sounds fun. So yeah, I will put my hands up and say that. I also will say I didn't enjoy my master's very much. So I didn't want my academic journey to end on a negative. And also a big part of it was I'd gone to university thinking I was going to become a particle physicist and I wanted to go work at CERN. And then I realized halfway through my degree that particles are very interesting to other people. And I'm not one of them. But the thing that I like the most is that everyone else in my year hated was that every time, like once you got into like third year and you were like really in the nitty gritty of like, you can really get into science, every single module came back to quantum physics. Like we had quantum modules, but it's like you do nuclear, you do particle, you do atomic, like all the different scales. And in the end, you were solving very similar problems. And that was really fascinating to me. And it was actually a friend of mine that was 2 years above me. He came to the CDT first, and a few weeks before he was due to leave, he sent me a leaflet being like, hey, this is what I'm doing, you should apply. And the rest is history, I guess, after that, after the second application anyway.
Yeah,
that's really nice. I'm finding it mildly funny because you've managed to land on something that we've run into previously on the podcast, which is the idea of scale being very relative. Because you said like atomic, nuclear, and particles, like all scales come back to quantum. I'm like, okay, these are all very, very, very tiny scales. Yeah. Whereas I previously referred to as the distance between the Earth and the Sun as very small.
Yeah. And then we had a fight. Yes.
I remember that. I will say that I didn't do cosmology at undergrad, but my friend that did, one day, she was so annoyed, she came up to after a lecture and she was like, there's quantum in cosmology too. Can you get out of everything? And I was like, oops, sorry. Yeah. It's not my fault. It's the universe's fault, but I guess it's my fault. So it does exist everywhere if you look hard enough.
Yeah, no, it definitely does.
I mean, it's even in my maths, so you really can't escape it.
Can't. Everywhere.
When did you pick your PhD topic? Like, so quantum, yes, but like more specifically than that, was that something that you went into the PhD knowing, or did your CDT sort of let you come up with it while you were there? Like, what was the vibe that way?
So I didn't pick my project until about a month before I was due to move on to the research phase. Mm-hmm. So Bristol CET is the standard 3+1. The way that we do our training year is that for the first 3 months, you're doing like a group lab project. Like even if you come in as a theorist or experimentalist, you do a group project together. And then we do what called Project A and Project B. So you get two sets of 3 months to pick a supervisor at Bristol or sometimes external, but they try and keep it internal in the first year. And you do as if you're doing that PhD for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then you swap them around. So you go with someone else. They encourage us to do one theory, one experimental, even if you're set on which one you are. They're like, just try it out. You might change your mind. It has happened before. And then at the end of that, those three sections, you're also doing taught modules on top. But after those two projects, you then have to propose two projects or sort of discuss and or have two ideas in mind. And then you once you propose those and the CDT's gone, these are reasonable, these are PhD size projects, you have to then pick one.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of start end of September, early October time, once you submitted them in like mid-August. And then you just go for your life, have fun.
And that's that. The rest is history. That's where you're at with it.
Yeah. Yeah, with the obvious knowledge that PhD projects change and flow over time, mine has changed. The core of my project hasn't changed, but the how you're going to achieve that aim has changed quite a lot since the beginning.
Okay. So can I ask you in sort of, I'm going to use the word layman, even though I hate it, terms, to explain to our wonderful listeners what your research is?
Yes. So my research is, I'm going to use the fancy words and then I'll explain. So I'll break it down a little bit. That's good. So I simulate, I'm very much a theorist, I simulate rubidium vapor quantum memories. The rubidium is an element, it's an alkali metal. You can do what I'm doing in physium as well, but there's reason why you don't, because rubidium's just better. vapor sounds like fluids, secretly isn't.
Beg to differ?
Also, the alkali metals, they're the ones if you throw them in water, they blow up, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Which, sorry, can I completely segue? Brainiac faked. Did y'all hear about this?
No.
Someone was telling me Brainiac... Okay, so there is an article on the internet that people can go fact check this, but someone was telling me that Brainiac used to, like, over-exaggerate their experiments. And one of the ones that that they've admitted to was the cesium in a bathtub one, and they just added dynamite.
I mean, that'll do it.
They basically were like, it wasn't big enough of an explosion, and fundamentally we're an entertainment company, and like, people should know that we're entertainers first, not scientists. Yeah, I was getting all the deep dive on behind the scenes of Brainiac, but there's a article somewhere on the internet that it goes into more detail. But yeah, how mind-boggling is that?
That's crazy.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay, so rubidium yay, cesium no is all I'm taking from this episode.
Cesium, if the cesium scientists come at me, cesium is great, but like, there's reasons for and against in the specific method that I simulate.
Okay.
That was very diplomatic.
When I say vapor, it's sort of around the 90 to 100 degrees C. A lot of people, like, when I say warm vapor rubidium, they say, oh yeah, but like quantum warm or what? Which quantum warm was like 4 Kelvin. And I'm like, no, classically warm. And then they ask the follow-up question, which is, how are you doing quantum physics at classical temperatures? And I go, good question. I'll get back to you when I have a PhD in this to answer. But it does work. It's been proven. So the other part of that fancy title is quantum memory, which I sort of alluded to earlier. And the best description I have is, it's kind of like the equivalent of a quantum hard drive, in the sense of you make your quantum information, which is generally in the form of photon, so little packets of light, and you can encode information in them in various degrees of freedom, but they're very, very delicate. And so if you're not using them immediately on the order of like nanoseconds.
So fast.
Just sort of context, the scales are fast. They will, basically their quality will go down. We say they decohere. And so if you've got multiple systems that are creating this information that need to be combined at the same time, but one process is longer than the other or further away, quantum memories are basically made so you put the photons in and you hold them and then you let them go. The scale of time you're holding them for varies based on your like platform massively. Like, we're on the order of like nanosecond. If you can use microwave systems and stuff, some of them have gone up to like actual seconds, which is crazy amount of time. Like, I don't know how to explain to people how you're going from 10^-9 of a second to an actual second. Some people are actually magic experimenters. They literally just perform magic at this point. But yeah, you hold the information and then you release it on demand and it carries on its merry way, and they sort of go and do with it what they need, hence the sort of hard drive approximation.
Okay, so like, it, yeah, can you store something without it sort of losing potency?
Yeah, some people might refer to it as like fidelity. It's basically just the quality of the information, like how similar is it to what you put in, because it's not that you, I mean, you can lose the photon, but it's normally the photon is there, it's just the shape of it or whatever, it is wonky, and therefore it's incorrect, and that's not helpful.
We don't want wonky photons.
No,
we do not want wonky.
The sincerity that the physicists came out with just then. Yeah, okay, sure.
To be fair, like, just to put like the difference between like a nanosecond and a second into context for people who don't normally deal with numbers with powers of 10, that's like scaling 1 second to 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the level of difference in timescale we're talking about, like in terms of proportions.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of that will come down to like, what elements people are using. Like, there's groups that use ions, that use rare earth metals, that use alkali metals. Some people do it hot, some people do it like at cryogenic temperatures, and they all have their pros and cons. One of the main pros of the system that I use is it's much more scalable, in the sense of getting a cell of a couple centimeters long to 90 to 100 degrees is actually quite easy, like, and making the cells on the scale of things that physicists can do is fairly easy. And so a big application is quantum repeaters. You just put quantum in front of everything. We haven't noticed. We're not inventive. A quantum repeater is basically just, if you think of your Wi-Fi network and every so often you need to have a signal booster, that's what a quantum repeater is, but for quantum networks. There we go. Quantum thing.
That makes sense.
And that is what quantum means in this scenario.
Yeah.
That is what quantum means. Thank you for that reference, Tom.
Huh? Are you unfamiliar with this?
I think Thomas is referencing the stories that I post occasionally, which is I find things in the world or friends send me things that are called Quantum X. And then I'm like, this is not what quantum is.
Ah.
Which is my favorite thing. So, I mean, if people ever do find something like that, I love it. It makes my day. There's only one thing on that list currently that is like, this is actually quantum. And it was the one thing that someone sent me going, I knew this isn't quantum. And I had to be like, actually, that one. Sorry, that one is quantum.
Okay. I think my favorite one of that, like, that's not what quantum means, is it's going to be like there's a place in Cardiff called Quantum Coffee.
Oh my god.
Do you go pick fights with a barista whenever you're visiting?
No, I did go there once.
You can hear the pain.
Which was, it was my mum's idea. She's like, come on, for the content. And I was like, thanks, mum. Love that.
We love a supporter.
And I think their meaning of the word quantum just means like new.
Okay.
But like futuristic new. Because they were like, our coffee is quantum roasted. And I was like, I don't think it is.
I seriously doubt they're roasting one bean at a time.
Yeah. I was like, if you're roasting singular beans, I will allow the use of this word. Because you're just meaning that it's like quantized, which is fine. But you're not, because that's inefficient on a consumer scale. So
yeah, that's fair enough. I do enjoy the buzzword though. It's quite fantastic.
It was what got me my place at Bristol, I think, because I went on a 5+ minute long tangent about if you want the actual what I talked about, it was the use of quantum as a buzzword is dangerous to the community. Mm-hmm. What I actually talked about was quantum dishwasher tablets annoy me. Because I started really going on a rant about finished quantum dishwasher tablets.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to say Ant-Man.
I've never seen Ant-Man.
Right. Well, when you do,
and this is partly why
this is the review that we all need. Real scientist watches Ant-Man, breaks down the physics. Like, it writes itself.
Didn't Dom of Domain of Science? Didn't he do one of those? He watched
very possibly.
I can't remember what he watched. Something, and it was like quantum physicist reacts to. And I barely got through him suffering through it because I was also suffering.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's doing a service to the entire quantum community.
To be fair, the reason I bring up Ant-Man is purely because there is a point where they just like poke fun at themselves in one of the films. And Ant-Man's just like, you guys just put quantum in front of everything, don't you?
The only quote I know from Ant-Man is they say, we went smaller than atoms and then smaller than molecules. And I was like, that's
the wrong way around.
Oh, my goodness me.
And this is why the sciences and the arts should work together, guys. Just putting that one out there.
Yep.
Okay, so I actually do have a question, because this isn't the first time, A, that we've met, or B, that I've heard about your research. And I am noticing a significant lack of orcas in your explanation.
Yes. So, for context for the listeners, we are all big fans of Dr. Simon Clark. He did not ClarkCon, oops, I mean Simon SciComCon.
The fact that you can remember that off the bat, very nice. Like, we had to deal with all the marketing behind the scenes, but, like, excellently done.
It's just how often he said, no, it's not called ClarkCon. And I was lucky enough to present a lightning talk of my research. When was that? 2022?
23.
23. Oh, my God. Okay, so I was a year in at that point. And the protocol that I was using at the time was known as Orca. And I went with this because I'm like, If I can't be funny, which is my first aim in an academic talk, I can't be memorable. So orcas on everything.
I mean, clearly it worked.
I went so far in my next presentation, I had the bottom bar of my presentation was a bit of water and my orca swam through it to show you how far through the talk I was.
I love that. That's nice. Amazing.
And I know Kat and I have joked on in stream about me doing an anamorphs of an orca in the corner of my thesis. And at this point, I feel like I will procrastinate enough to do that. If my supervisor heard that, no, I won't. I promise.
You didn't hear nothing. We didn't endorse nothing.
So ORCA stands for off-resonant cascaded absorption, which is a fancy way of saying that instead of going up energy levels in a triangle shape, so you go up the top and down halfway down, you just go up and down the ladder, which basically means that certain forms of that decoherence I talked about earlier don't exist. You can just ignore them. They don't happen, which is very, very helpful because it means you go from solving 16 simultaneous equations down to about 4 or 6.
Seems like an improvement.
It is. I do not use ORCA anymore. I use a new protocol that we're using that I think I'm allowed to talk about, which is called flora instead. Aww. So now instead of orcas, it's flowers.
That's better. Go with that. Orcas are pretty cool.
See, my brain went to fake butter, but sure.
Flora, which stands for four level of resident absorption. I don't know why we got rid of the word cascaded, but it is still cascaded, but flora was much nicer than florca,
yeah.
I think. I didn't name it that, unfortunately, but I still think we transitioned from orcas to flowers, but I kind of try and mishmash them together because it's like an improvement on an iteration on orca. So I've had real fun with Photoshop, which I'm not good at.
Mm, flowers made of orcas or orcas made of flowers? Or like anamorph, but flower to...
Normally it's just orca with flower coming out of breathing hole because I'm really bad at art.
No, I love that.
That's perfect, yeah.
Or with a flower tattoo. I'm like,
yes.
Stick them together, easy.
Yeah, because I was the at the Simon Clark SciCon con Clark Con thing.
Good job.
Thanks. I had to do the lightning talk prep, so I was the one behind the scenes dealing with all of that stuff. And I remember getting really excited about your talk coming in because I was like, this is so not what I'm expecting, because you see orcas and then you read quantum and you're like, wait a minute. But you're right, it is memorable.
A lot of people assume I'm a marine biologist, especially when I tell people that my master's dissertation was based on squids. So I've done squids and orcas and now flowers. They're like, oh, you're a biologist. And I'm like, I could not be further away from biology if I tried.
I feel like we do need to set you up with a marine biologist and you two give like each other's talks and see if it will like translate. I'm currently in a process of trying to petition a friend of mine that does trees to do a talk about probability, because I, again, would enjoy the mix of botany and probability just smushing together. We sort of touched upon it. So you did the... not Clark Con presentation, and Thomas mentioned your Instagram posts again. Do you do a lot of science communication and outreachy stuff?
I do. I slowed down for a while with all the online stuff because of mental health and ADHD related reason, but I do. I recently published an article in Physics World about being a neurodivergent scientist, which I feel like is that's technically science communication, right? We can talk through all that in there.
Definitely. You are communicating science and around science and for science. That, yeah.
Exactly. I am on a podcast.
What? Which one?
But I also...
News to us.
I have given talks at schools about my journey into quantum physics. I have been to many science festivals. I was in London in July for... the Quantum Zone, which is part of the Royal Society's Summer Science Festival, teaching people about quantum physics. Bristol has a little demonstration that's called Pi Quantum, and it basically is a little video game showing you how to program a quantum computer, which sounds really impressive until you realize it's a breadboard with LEDs on it, but it's still very impressive. And teaching people how to use it is not intuitive. Using it is not necessarily intuitive. But that was a good highlight, is I managed to get there was a child that was really good at it and he beat me in a race. So that was impressive.
Oh, wow.
So yes, I do talk a lot about science and quantum especially, but any science that is cool.
That's very funky. What is your favourite non-quantum thing that you've done a talk or event about?
That is a good question. I think the closest thing that comes to mind is like, when I was in my first CDT year, they take people to Swindon Science Festival, and I was not enough of a quantum physicist to just talk quantum physics, so I had a lot of more generic physics conversations. But I think the best / worst thing is with those things is you have an idea of what you want to talk to someone about. You're like, I'm going to talk to this person and teach them quantum physics, but meeting them where they're at, and actually there's more interesting conversations when you just sort of accept if someone's going to come to me and ask me a question or not know something, and we might go into like, I've gone into math and statistics, I've gone into like generic physics, I had a chat with someone about chemistry once, though I'm not qualified to do that at all. It's interesting, it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, that it's a very like bold thing to do, to be like, you can ask me questions about sort of whichever direction you want to go. It's I think it's a very good skill to learn. It's a very hard skill to learn. Most of it is just faking it till you make it, right? Like that's, unless you know something I don't, that's definitely what I've been doing.
No, I think this year, the one in London was where I truly, the first time I actually felt comfortable being like, I'm on this particular stand. We had like a whole room to ourselves of all the different bits of quantum. And I was like, I'm on this stand and I've trained to talk about this like demonstration. being very aware that it's like, I'm just going to get generic quantum or just generic physics questions. Or yeah, it's hard to just be like, I have confidence in myself and my knowledge and my ability to talk to people and my ability to suss out where they're at.
It's difficult to like quickly figure out what that baseline is, but then once you get there, that's such a good skill.
I think what's helped with me in that is that Bristol has a quantum summer school every year, and it was last week at time of recording, and having done that 4 years in a row now, I've given the same talk. I co-present the superposition introductory talk, and having done it 4 times now, it's really helped me like pitch it at a good level. And like this year was the best feedback I've gotten from the kids. I say kids, they're like late A level students, so nearly not kids, and they were all like interacting and actually doing the little experiment I set up. So that was also really nice to see, of like, the first time you do any science communication thing, you are going to suck at it. This is the same with anything, but you can't let that discourage you from doing it again, because you're only going to get better by continuing to suck until you suck a bit less.
I've been asked the same sort of thing of like, how do I get better at SciComm stuff? Because like, and people are normally asking me on a sort of online science communications perspective, but yeah, it's that same sort of thing of like, you're going to suck at it for a very, very long time until you eventually get better, I think. But someone explained it to me for like online videos, like your first 100 videos are going to be terrible, but you've got to get them out of the way.
And also depending on the type of science communication, there is also like, there is some overlap, but if you're like used to doing, say, long short form video, and then you go to doing it in person, like there will be carryover, but it's a very different set of skills. Like if you make content, if you screw it up, you can just record it again. If it's in person in front of someone, you can't. Written versus visual as well. It's like they're all helpful to each other, but if you move from one to the other, you go back to the beginning of your skill level is like, I suck again, which is discouraging, but you've got to move with the times and trying to keep that being exciting, not daunting, to the best of your ability.
Speaking of, you said you recently wrote an article. Tell us more, please.
I wanted to dabble my fingers in all the little SciComm pies where possible before I finished the PhD. And I did write an article about being a neurodivergent scientist. It was on the cover, which I didn't know about until it arrived and was so exciting. I did a little cry.
Aww.
Just a little one.
Mm-hmm.
But it was inspired by the person I interviewed, who's called Daisy. They are the outreach and public engagement lead at National Quantum Computing Center. They have my dream job, basically. If you guys don't have my dream job, then Daisy does. And they are openly autistic, and they do a lot of like neurodiverse advocacy. And that's like the other facet of my life that means a lot to me. Like doing science and making science better for like women, neurodivergent people, minorities, all of that. So approaching the editor-in-chief of Physics World at a careers event in Bristol to be like, hey, I am important enough to talk to you and I'm going to write an article for you and you're going to love it, was absolutely poop in my pants. But he agreed and I wrote it. I got to interview them and chat to them more, which was lovely. And I'm very proud of that article. It was hard to write and harder to put out there, because talking about stuff that you're bad at and putting that in a fairly, in the physics community, quite a well-known magazine and being like, hey, I'm really bad at this and this and this because I'm disabled, is really hard. Because, you know, I was thinking, is this going to harm my career prospects? Is this going to make people think less of me? To which it shouldn't, and it shouldn't. But
this is not the world we live in.
Yeah, there's a lot of stigma around neurodivergence. And I've heard too many times, you can't have ADHD because you're clever, because you're doing a PhD. If you had ADHD, you'd be stupid, which is horrific and untrue.
Yep.
It's also a case of the neurodivergent people are overrepresented in the sciences. It's something like up to 10% have ADHD, up to 18%. These are not the right statistics in the article, but it's some double-digit numbers have ADHD, autism, or both. And then you consider the rest of the umbrella, like the dyslexics, all the mental health issues. We're just leaving these people in the dust, and that's not on, in my opinion. So I am metaphorically sticking my neck out, I guess, to be the person that's like, this needs to stop. It needs to stop now.
Yeah.
So it was empowering and cathartic, terrifying, but a good experience confidence-wise in talking to people that are important mm-hmm. and going, I'm also important, I deserve to take up this space in general, which is hard when you're a mm-hmm. PhD student, being like, no, I know what I'm talking about, I deserve to be heard. You know, that applies to writing papers, it applies to projects, it applies to a lot of stuff. But also putting it out there and being like, no, this is the reality of doing a PhD as someone who has an PhD. It sucks.
Yeah.
And doing a PhD sucks anyway.
yeah.
And I had pushback, people being like, oh, you know, you're trying to make your PhD easier than normal people. It's like, no, I'm not. I'm trying to make it even. Mm. And there are extra struggles, and that shouldn't be a hard thing to say. If like, no, we struggle more in different ways and we need accommodations to fix that, that shouldn't be a taboo subject. So I'm very proud that I wrote it, and I really enjoy it, and people should read it if they are interested.
And you'll be able to read it because it will be in the description. A link to it will be in the description on YouTube and in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening on.
No, it is an incredible thing that you've done. I think there's one thing to sort of stand up and say, I'm going to advocate for this group, and it's another one to really be very visible as a member of said group. For all of the reasons that you said, like it is much more visible as a, this is a person that is affected by this specific thing.
I felt it to a lesser extent when I sort of came out at work as being bisexual, like that. Like, I remember back when I came out the first time when I was a teenager, that was the big thing. Like, it was a lot less accepted then. But I feel like this is like that on steroids. Because with, you know, sexuality, you can kind of like, it's one of those things you can hide if you need or want to. For, mm-hmm. for to an extent, like at work, not saying that anybody should ever feel the need to. But it's like, I could technically never bring it up at work and mm-hmm. no one would know. But yeah. The way my literal brain works, how long it takes me to answer emails, how distracted I get in meetings, that's not something I can turn off and mask all the time. That's not reasonable or possible. So it felt both more and less scary because everyone I knew that I told about it, they were like, oh yeah, we know. But it, like in a supportive way, they were like, we get it. It's actually some of my family and my partner's family found out about my ADHD through this article, which was helpful.
Oh, wow.
And but they've all been laughing about it. Everyone's been like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Sorry, I'm just getting really emotional on your behalf now. that's what's happening. I'm just like, oh no, I think it is incredible. I think the best way that we can sort of do, beyond being like the loud angry people being like, we need to friggin' kick all these barriers down and do things, is by having people like yourself willing to be visible representation. And it's awful to put all that extra work on top of you of like, not only are you going through this thing, but now we need you to talk about it all of the time. But when we're able to have that space to do that, is where I think you make the most connections with people that maybe don't understand, because we're seeing, you know, your actual experiences coming through of like, it's no longer conceptual, it's a real person.
I think that's the two most common responses I had was from neurodivergent scientists being like, thank you, I feel seen. And from non-neurodivergent scientists being like, I had no idea because it's just not something that occurred to me. And now I know I can be out on the lookout for it, but like in a positive way. Like yeah. I can look for those barriers when they exist and dismantle them before someone else has to headbutt them, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
Which was, that's the best thing. And like, if it helps one person, which it already has, that was my aim. It helped me at the very least. but just like knowing that other people out there are going to read that and take even one thing away from it is that was the aim.
Yeah, because we definitely want people to go and read the article and check that out because it's really cool. But if we could have like a little snippet of an example or accommodation that people can sort of do and look out for our wonderful listeners.
Yes, I will make the disclaimer of, if you've met one neurodivergent person, you've met one neurodivergent, please check with your neurodivergence before applying blanket
yes.
advice. But
yes.
I think a
this
big
feels
one
like you're
is...
saying please ask Bill Pierce permission before proceeding. But
kind of is though, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is,
it really
but
is.
It's true. Is I think just patience with any kind of neurodivergent person. Just people in general, like I think if the world would be a better place if everyone was just a bit more patient as a whole. But it's just things can take us longer to do or to process or to understand. And if you need to repeat yourself, if they ask for written instructions, if they ask for more time to do something, just it all comes down to essentially just patience and understanding. Even if you do not understand why someone needs something, it's not your place to decide if they do or don't, and to just listen and be willing to accept that someone else's way of thinking is not the same as yours. And just because you or someone else you know can do it does not mean that everyone can at any given moment. If they could yesterday, if they could 5 minutes ago, they might not be able to anymore. And just being aware of that and being able to, where possible, work with that.
Completely agree. Amazing. But don't worry, all of our listeners are going to go and read the article soon. So
You are going to go and read it.
This is your homework for next episode. But also more stuff like that needs to exist in the world.
If anyone has the opportunity to write something like that or wants to reach out to someone to see if that's possible, please just do it. It's really hard, but whatever you want to say is worth being heard.
Mm.
As long as it's not hateful.
Yeah.
Please be nice. But everyone deserves to be listened to, especially if you're in one of those minorities of any kind. Like, we're here, we deserve to be heard. Just put your words out there. Someone will listen and will understand. If you have like an institute of or similar thing for your given science or subject, if they have a publishing bit that has like a magazine that's not like a journal, the chances are they may at least be open to the idea of you submitting. So the worst thing is you get an email that says, no, sorry, we don't do like guest contributions or whatever, which is like sad, but not the end of the world.
Starting blogs and articles and Substacks and sharing on socials as well, which is something that we all do in our own spare time with our own opinions anyway, which is quite fun.
And if you don't want to write everything down, you can just start a podcast, create loads of work for yourself.
That is what all the cool kids are doing. This is true. Best way to start a podcast, get a Thomas to help.
If you can't start your own because you don't have anyone to co-host with, bug your favorite science communicators until they invite you on theirs.
100% foolproof method.
We just have to see how many more episodes/months of bugging it takes until I can come back. what's the half life of me on this podcast? I love that I'm in a podcast where we will have really inventive usernames. Miss Cat Does Maths. Sorry, Dr. Cat Does Maths.
Thank you.
Tom Astrosci and Quantum Dragon, but without the M, because it was taken.
Is that why? I did wonder.
I presume it was just multiple quanta.
Well, a quanta is just a particle, and dragon is like, I'm Welsh, and therefore that's my whole personality.
Uh-huh. Imagine being like that. Who would dare? But given that we have a Welsh person on the podcast, can you say the place name in North Wales, please?
Is that because you can't?
I can! How dare you?
That is a joke because I have redeemed that on Cat's stream too many times. Cat knows I'm joking. I can say the place name. It is Danvar Perswingis Ugarachundum and Fantasilo Gugogoch.
Fantastic. Thomas, your turn.
I knew you were going to do that.
This was all a setup.
Of course it was. Clanbrabachundu Ugarachundrabo Fantasilo Gugogoch.
Aw, he does live in Wales now.
I could see this before I moved.
Well, Thomas is the first Scottish person that says my name right, so I'm impressed.
Yay. I mean, with instruction, but thank you.
Well, my undergraduate supervisor, God bless him, is Australian, and he couldn't say it. And there was him and a Scottish lecturer that I think is now retired, maybe. And I walked into them chatting in his office just before my supervision meeting, and they were both coaching each other on how to say it. But because their accents are so thick, they can't say it in sort of English way that I say it, because God knows I don't sound Welsh at all. I promise I'm not a fraud. I am from Wales. Mm. But they were just coaching each other on how to say it. It was the sweetest thing. They couldn't do it, but
adorable.
It was the sweetest thing.
But yeah, so obviously, the long place name lives rent free in the head of everyone that lives in Wales. Speaking of other things that live sort of rent free, the thing we're sort of going to ask guests is what is your Roman Empire? And to explain the what is your Roman Empire question, this was a meme from like a wee while ago that just lives rent free in my head, which is the idea that like what is the thing that you like think about like way too often or like way too much about?
I think I'm opportunity to have one long-term one. Currently, it's building a PC because that's what I did most recently for my partner. And I'm looking at mine. They can't see that I'm staring at mine, but my partner's didn't go very well. So currently that, the difference between ATX motherboard is currently in my head. The knowledge of ADHD in the world would be the other one, of just like people like telling people about it, being like, hey, you're all wrong about this and you need to not be wrong, and I have the information, I'm going to give it to you.
No, I think those are very valid and entertaining. Roman empires, are we calling them that? Hyperfixation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unstable Fluid Podcast, and thanks again to Megan for coming on and being our first guest. If you want to follow Megan on social media, their socials are in the show notes or description, and you can of course read their Physics World article, also linked in the description. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share it with a friend, and we will see you next time on the Unstable Fluid Podcast.